You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych has returned to work today after taking a four-day sick leave as the political crisis in his country continues to boil over. We're joined now by Yale history professor and Institute for Human Sciences fellow Timothy Snyder. He is the author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. Very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Hello. Very glad to speak to you again.
Ukraine was roiled by protests between 2004 and 2005. Should we think of this as a continuation of that crisis?
Well, some of the basic issues are the same. You have a very large number of people who are dissatisfied by the lack of the rule of law. You have a very large number of people who are willing to go out on the streets and take risks in order to try to get the sorts of things that we take for granted, free elections, human rights, and so forth. But so there's a basic similarity, but things have gotten worse in the meantime. The rich poor gap has grown. This regime is more corrupt than that one was. And so I think now we're facing a situation which is rather more extreme and risky.
But Yanukovych was elected. Was it a fair election?
It was probably a more or less fair election, but unfortunately, bad things can happen after elections. He changed the constitution in a way which was, according to at least local legal authorities, not at all legitimate, thereby increasing his power quite considerably. He then packed the Supreme Court, putting someone in charge who is the same person who managed to lose some legal records, which were very compromising for Yanukovych. And then on the 16th of January, he had his deputies in parliament, by a show of hands, which was very weird, overturn most of the basic democratic and human rights of the population of Ukraine. So he was elected, but since he's been elected, he's changed the system in some pretty fundamental ways, which I think have undermined not only his popularity, which is very low all over the country, but perhaps also his legitimacy.
Well, the parliament, the Verkhovna Rada, has recently voted to scrap those anti-protest laws. Do you think that'll ease some of the tensions?
Well, yes and no. It's perhaps a good sign that the regime is willing to take steps, but it actually only scrapped some of those laws and not all of them, and it made the amnesty on the opposition contingent on the opposition going home. So if somebody is still protesting, they're still a criminal until they stop protesting. So in that fairly fundamental sense, basic freedoms such as assembly still don't exist in the country. Meanwhile, people are still disappearing from the streets. People are still being beaten and tortured. And the list of people whose whereabouts are unknown only grows longer. So I don't think we're looking at something like the end of this crisis, no.
And hasn't Yanukovych had members of the military sign a promise of loyalty, which would suggest that he sees some confrontation in the future?
Again, you know, when you ask me to say what's going to come next, it's very hard for me to say what's going to come next. There have been so many surprises here from the very beginning. I mean, the first surprise was when Yanukovych in November decided not to sign an agreement with the European Union, which he had already initialed and which it looked like he was going to sign. At the last minute, he got a lot of money from the Russians and didn't sign, which is what started the protests. Then he sent policemen to beat those protesters, which was also a surprise. Then Putin came in with lots of more money and low gas prices, another surprise. Then on January 16th, Yanukovych passed these laws, or had these laws passed by a show of hands, which led to massive resistance and also more violence. That was a surprise and probably a mistake. So it's very hard to know what's going to happen next. We're in a very fluid situation.
And then,
the fact that he's asking for declarations of loyalty means that he's probably considering martial law, but it might also be a sign that he's not sure he could actually carry it off.
And then another surprise is the Russians, the cabinet has decided not to give the $15 billion line of credit to Ukraine. at least not unless certain things happen. You wrote an op-ed piece for today's New York Times, and the title was, Don't Let Putin Grab Ukraine. Should we think of this as a proxy conflict between Russia and the European Union?
No. I think we should fundamentally think of this as an effort by Ukrainians themselves to try to secure a decent sort of life. Ukraine is, however, in the middle of Europe. It's a country the size of France with 15 million people. It's on the edge of the European Union. The people who protested from the beginning, and most of those protesting now, want to have a life like that, the people in the European Union. That doesn't mean that the European Union necessarily takes an interest, but it also has a long border with Russia. And Putin's main geopolitical project is something called the Eurasian Union. And the Eurasian Union, which is a kind of resurrection of the Soviet Union on a smaller scale, only makes sense if he can get Ukraine to join. But the thing is, nobody likes the Eurasian Union, basically, except for dictators. And so in order for a country to join the Eurasian Union, it has to be a dictatorship first. Putin gave Yanukovych the money. I mean, we can assume on the assumption that Yanukovych could crush the protests. Now Yanukovych has tried and failed, apparently, to crush the protests. So Putin is taking the money back. And that's where we are.
Although you write that unlike Europe and the United States, Russia has a clear stance on Ukraine. What would you say that is?
It's sort of interesting. I mean, when you read, like, I'm spending all of my time reading the American press, the French press, the British press, the German and Austrian press, the Polish and the Ukrainian and the Russian press. And if you read, you read the Russian stuff, it's fairly clear that there's an ideological commitment to some kind of strong relationship with Ukraine. The problem is the fuzziness of it all. The ideology doesn't explain exactly how Russia is going to control policy within Ukraine. It's just not clear how they're going to get from A to B. And the sort of logical problem is if you want Ukraine in your union, you have to be able to control the government. But to control the government, you may have to intervene. And what I worry about is that the Russians, precisely because they have a clear idea that they want to control Ukraine, but they don't have a clear idea about how they're going to do it, are going to get themselves into a much worse mess than they expect, which would get themselves into some kind of intervention and conflict, which would be, of course, not only a disaster for Ukraine, but a disaster for Russia as well.
Is the situation complicated by the fact that Ukraine has a large Russian-speaking population?
I don't think that's quite the way to do it. I mean, we start with language often because a lot of us like to think in terms of language determining, national identity, although, of course, it doesn't. I mean, if it did, the country where I am, Austria, wouldn't exist because everybody here speaks German, and the country where you are, America, also wouldn't exist because English is the main language there, right? So it can't be as simple that language equals nation. Most of the people who are out on the streets in Kiev protesting the government are native Russian speakers. And in normal times, Russian is the dominant language of the capital city of Ukraine, just like English is the dominant language in Washington, D.C., or in Ottawa, or in Sydney, or what have you. So it's not as simple as language. But there certainly are deep political differences in the country, just, again, much like in the United States. I mean, anyone who's trying to rule a big politically divided country is going to have to be in a position to make some kind of compromise. But no, it doesn't come down to ethnic conflict. It comes down to, legitimately different political experiences and expectations about the future. Most people in Ukraine think they should be closer to the European Union, but not everyone does. And in a normal political situation, that would be a debate that you would have in a free press, rather than the debate that's handled by repression and violence.
Yanukovych's supporters fear the secular nature of Western Europe and cite things like same-sex marriage as a reason to reject the EU.
That's a really interesting point because you're hitting on an important, I think, a really important and new development in international politics. That comes from Putin. That comes from Russia. The Russians have hit on gay rights as an issue to divide Western civilization and to get support from the right wing in the West and to scare people who have traditional values. So a few weeks ago, the man who was then a high official in Ukrainian government, he's now no longer is, stood in Kiev and told people that he would love to give them visas to travel to the European Union, but he couldn't because the precondition was that he had to accept same-sex marriage, which was completely wrong. It's complete balderdash. It was nonsense. But the idea is to make everyone think that Europe is only about homosexuality and gay rights. And this is now a drumbeat in the Russian media. On Russian television, it's unbelievably intense. You know, it reaches the absurd levels of claiming that Vitaly Klitschko, the former heavyweight champion who's one of the opposition leaders in Ukraine, it's claimed on Russian TV that the only reason he's popular in Europe is that he's a gay icon, right? Which would be sort of funny if issues of human rights and, you know, a national liberation weren't at stake. So yeah, that's a new form of politics which is being applied, and it's interesting, although of course it's also quite horrible.
And wasn't the European Union also pressuring Yanukovych to release the former prime minister Yulia Tymoshenko from prison? She's been in prison for a long time. I'm not exactly sure what she was eventually convicted of.
Yulia Tymoshenko was defeated by Yanukovych in the last presidential elections by a fairly narrow margin, and then he had her imprisoned on what everyone considers to be politically motivated charges of corruption in a natural gas deal with Russia several years before.
Well,
you
write that Mr. Yanukovych's family has amassed unbelievable wealth during his pregnancy. So I guess if she comes back into power, she could put him into prison?
I think that's something that we all need to be thoughtful about as we approach some kind of resolution, which I think the U.S. and the EU are moving towards trying to do. You don't want this to be some kind of revenge match. You know, his family has become incredibly wealthy. His son's a dentist and seems to be worth $130 million, which is not, you know, easy to accumulate in dentistry. But you certainly want to find some. I mean, even in New York, right? I mean, you want to find some way out which doesn't involve, you know, people who have been in prison taking revenge on other people by putting them in prison. Because precisely the problem is the absence of the rule of law. Precisely the problem is that Yanukovych has been able to decide who's going to go to prison. And, of course, she's the most famous, but she's not the only political prisoner. All the oppositionists who have just been taken from the public square in Kiev and jailed and beaten are also political prisoners. They haven't done anything which you're not allowed to do in normal times.
And it was reported that one of the protest leaders, Dmitry Bulatov, has just resurfaced after having been missing for 8 days. He's claiming to have been kidnapped and beaten during this time. However, government officials are denying those allegations. But you're suggesting that kidnapping and beating are common intimidation tactics being used on protesters.
It seems to be the latest thing. I mean, first they tried to overcome the protests with brute force, just by having riot police come with their shields and their batons. Then they were using rubber bullets, which have taken out several eyes and broken several hands and done a lot of damage to people. It's not at all. Rubber bullets are a very serious thing. A couple of people were killed. Then they were using water cannons. Some of them just died of hypothermia after water cannons were used in sub-freezing temperatures. It's also something extremely cruel to do. But they're having trouble now breaking up the protests at that kind of mass level, just because the protests keep going on with such numbers, and the riot police only number a few thousand at the end of the day. So the latest tactic seems to be one of intimidation, in which people who are either well known as oppositionists or are simply random people making their way home from a protest are kidnapped, taken to some forest outside of the city, bags are placed over their head, they're beaten, they're asked. I mean, this is what they report. I'm reporting what the people who were kidnapped report, the ones who survived. They say they're beaten, they were tortured, they're asked who's funding the protests, who's leading the protests, what the ultimate goal is, and things like that. Questions which are really, you know, sort of absurd, because there isn't really any secret behind the protests. The motivations are pretty simple and straightforward. But yeah, I mean, you can't, of course, prove at this point that the government is doing it, but an awful lot of people are disappearing. And as to, you know, as to human rights abuses and beatings and torture generally, I mean, strangely, a lot of this stuff is on film. And you can see some activists who we know who they are in the process of being beaten by, in fact, the Ukrainian riot police.
And then there was a young man who was stripped of all of his clothing and forced to stand out in the cold. Dmitry Bulatov is currently traveling to Lithuania, which has promised to treat any protesters injured in the crisis. How are the troubles in Ukraine affecting its neighbors, and what would it mean for its neighbors if the present crisis ends with the fragmentation of the Ukrainian state?
Yeah, on his traveling to Lithuania, I just wanted to mention that one of the reasons why that's an issue is that the Ukrainian secret police keeps kidnapping injured activists from hospitals, so people can't go to hospital to be treated after they're beaten, because the very fact that they've been beaten makes them suspect, and the police will take them away, which is why one of the reasons why people want to go abroad or they go to doctors and private departments. But anyway, onto your bigger question, the dissolution of Ukraine would obviously be a disaster for everyone. I mean, since the Second World War, I mean, since the destruction of Austria, since the destruction of Czechoslovakia, you know, we know that a very important thing in Europe is the preservation of state sovereignty, and that changes in borders, if they're going to take place at all, have to be done in some kind of peaceful procedure that takes a long time and represents some kind of consent. The fragmentation of Ukraine under conditions of internal or external violence would be a disaster. I mean, it would break a big consensus in Europe. It would show the weakness of the European Union. All of the neighbors, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Moldova, would panic. And Russia, I mean, not last but not least, Russia would have a disaster on its hands. I mean, Russia has a hard enough time with Chechnya, where it's been fighting a war ever since Putin came to power with no sign of success. And in the Caucasus in general, as we all know from reading about Sochi, the Russians already have problems on their frontiers. If they seriously thought that, which I really don't think they do, and I really hope they don't, but if they seriously thought that they could occupy just their own chosen bits of Ukraine and somehow get away with it, I'm afraid they're in for a terrible surprise. I mean, even the people who are Russian-speaking, and even the people who watch Russian television aren't really that keen to have a Russian invasion of their country. And of course, Ukraine does have an army, however ill-paid and ill-fed and so on, and it's a rather big army, and it's rather well-armed. So it would be a disaster. I mean, I think much worse, and the very fact that it would be a disaster is the thing which I hope will stay the hand of the people who are talking about such things.
Timothy Snyder is a Yale history professor, and he's also with the Human he's a human sciences fellow, the author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. You might want to read his op-ed piece in today's New York Times. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for the conversation.